For the next hour, I'll be reading from the January 8, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: Warner Brothers Discovery recommended its shareholders reject Paramount's amended hostile bid for the company, saying its existing deal with Netflix is stronger. World Liberty Financial, the Trump family's flagship crypto venture, said that one of its entities has applied for a national banking license. JP Morgan Chase's asset management unit cut all ties with proxy advisory firms and will start using AI to assist on U.S. company votes. JP Morgan reached an agreement to take over the Apple credit card program from Goldman Sachs. Anthropic plans to raise $10 billion at a valuation of $350 billion before the new investment, nearly doubling its valuation from 4 months ago. Major U.S. stock indexes ended mixed, with the S&P 500 and Dow falling 0.3% and 0.9%, respectively, while the NASDAQ rose 0.2%. AbbVie is in advanced talks to buy cancer drug biotech Revolutionary Medicines in what would be one of the year's first mega deals. The private sector added a net 41,000 new employees last month after shedding 29,000 jobs in November, ADP estimated in its latest report. Media startup Semaphore raised $30 million in new financing that values the company at $330 million after its first profitable year. Samsung expects record above consensus earnings for its latest quarter, boosted by an AI-driven memory chip supercycle that is fueling demand for its products. A probe into Bank of America by India's financial regulator found the bank improperly shared material non-public information about a $180 million block trade. The key articles under the worldwide section: Trump and his advisors are planning a sweeping initiative to dominate the Venezuelan oil industry for years to come, and the president has told aides he believes his efforts could help lower oil prices to his favored level of $50 a barrel. The U.S. military forcibly boarded a ship being escorted by the Russian Navy and seized another tanker, accelerating its campaign against a shadow fleet of carriers that ship Venezuelan oil. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said he would meet with Danish and Greenlandic officials after the Danes requested a sit-down in hope of addressing criticism directed at them by the Trump administration. An AI startup and Google agreed to settle several lawsuits with families of teenagers who killed or harmed themselves after interacting with the startup's chatbot. Representative Steny Hoyer of Maryland, a longtime member of the House Democratic leadership, won't run for re-election. Trump administration officials made sweeping changes to federal dietary guidelines, recommending that people avoid highly processed foods, dramatically increase protein intake, and skip added sugar. Trump said he is taking steps to ban large investors from buying single-family homes. The CBO further trimmed its long-term forecast for the U.S. population growth. Florida Governor DeSantis said he would call a special session for the GOP-dominated legislature to draw new congressional districts. The picture on today's front page takes place outside where an SUV is parked curbside with yellow tape completely surrounding it. And in the background, FBI agents are talking to what appear to be witnesses. And that headline reads, Minneapolis on edge after fatal ICE shooting. The caption, divided. Authorities investigated Wednesday after an ICE officer shot to death a woman in her car during a confrontation with agents in Minneapolis. City and federal officials offered starkly different narratives about what led to the killing. The article, ICE Officer Kills Woman in Minnesota, by Victoria Albert, John McCormick, and Joseph Bassani. A U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer fatally shot a woman during an operation in Minneapolis on Wednesday, leaving federal and city officials sparring over what caused the deadly encounter. The Department of Homeland Security said that the woman attempted to run over law enforcement officers and that an agent fired in self-defense. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said he had seen a video of the incident and in fiery remarks disputed the department's version of events as bullsh, telling ICE to get out of the city. This was an agent recklessly using power that resulted in somebody dying, he said during a press conference Wednesday. He said the woman who died was 37 years old. When asked if the woman was using her vehicle as a weapon, as DHS alleged, he said that does not appear to be the case at all. The woman was identified by a family member as Renee Nicole Good. The Minneapolis City Council released a statement that said Good was out caring for her neighbors when the shooting occurred. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said the woman blocked ICE officers with her car. President Trump said he had seen video of the incident and it was being studied in its entirety. Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara said it appeared the woman was blocking the roadway when a federal law enforcement officer approached her on foot. The vehicle began to drive off, he said, and at least two shots were fired before the vehicle crashed. She was shot in the head. O'Hara said the woman didn't appear to be a target of the federal enforcement operation. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz urged residents to protest peacefully, adding that he issued a warning order to prepare the Minnesota National Guard. We won't let them tear us apart, he said. We'll not turn against each other. Earlier Wednesday, he echoed Frey. I've seen the video, he wrote on social media. Don't believe this propaganda machine. Articles from the front page follow. U.S. seizes two more tankers, adding to pressure on Caracas. By Shelby Holliday, Costas Paris, and Lara Sigelman. The U.S. military forcibly boarded a ship being escorted by the Russian Navy and seized another tanker on Wednesday, accelerating its campaign against a shadow fleet of tankers that ship Venezuelan oil. The confiscation of the two tankers extended an extraordinary string of actions on the high seas by the U.S. Defense Department and Coast Guard personnel, which are targeting vessels around Venezuela that the administration says are engaging in deceptive practices and carrying illicit oil shipments. Four vessels are now in U.S. custody, and the quasi-embargo in the Caribbean has crippled Venezuelan oil exports. The Justice Department is monitoring several more tankers for similar enforcement action, Attorney General Pam Bondi posted on X. The seizures mark another escalation in President Trump's pledge to take control of the Venezuelan oil industry, coming in the days after the U.S. deposed the country's leader, Nicolas Maduro, and said Venezuela would give the U.S. 30 million to 50 million barrels of oil, as much as 15% of the country's output. One broker estimated the value at between $1.5 billion and $2.5 billion. Early on Wednesday, a special operations force boarded a ship called the Marinera, a tanker formerly known as Bella One. The Coast Guard had been pursuing the vessel for 2 weeks on an odyssey that began near Venezuela and ended south of Iceland, U.S. officials said. Over that time, the ship, which wasn't carrying any oil, changed its name and claimed Russian protection. Adding to the stakes, a Russian Navy ship and submarine began escorting the tanker, the officials said. The submarine had been communicating with the tanker over the past 3 days, some of the officials said, and video from the Marinera was broadcast on RT, a Russian state-backed news channel. The Army's 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment played a prominent role in seizing the ship, according to photos of the operation. The U.S. also brought in P-8 Poseidon sub-Hunter aircraft, F-35 jet fighters, and AC-130J gunships to support the boarding operation since Russian military assets were nearby, according to open-source photos and U.S. officials. The officials said tanker captains and mechanics would be sent on board to operate the vessel. The UK helped support the US operation, British Defense Secretary John Healey said, adding, "This ship, with a nefarious history, is part of a Russian-Iranian axis of sanctions evasion, which is fueling terrorism, conflict, and misery from the Middle East to Ukraine." White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said the crew aboard Bella One would be subject to prosecution. This was a Venezuelan shadow fleet vessel that has transported sanctioned oil, and the United States of America under this president is not going to tolerate that, she said. Meanwhile, in the Atlantic near the Caribbean, U.S. forces seized a tanker, the Sophia. The tanker was trying to evade the U.S. blockade, according to a person familiar with the matter. In a social media post, U.S. Southern Command said that the vessel was operating in international waters and conducting illicit activities, and that the U.S. Coast Guard was escorting the ship to the U.S. In footage posted by Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem on Wednesday, armed U.S. forces can be seen boarding and searching the ship during a pre-dawn raid. Noem said that the Coast Guard, which has law enforcement authority on the high seas, conducted the boardings in coordination with the U.S. Departments of Defense, Justice, and State. Marine Traffic, which tracks international shipping, said that Sophia is operated by China-registered Gree Tea Company. The company couldn't be reached for comment. Marine Traffic said the Sophia was carrying about 2 million barrels of Venezuelan crude loaded from December 26th to 29th. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump works to dominate Venezuela oil sector. Plan seeks to control most of the hemisphere's crude, aims to lower prices to $50 a barrel. By Brian Schwartz, Benoit Morin, and Josh Dossey. President Trump and his advisors are planning a sweeping initiative to dominate the Venezuelan oil industry for years to come, and the president has told aides he believes his efforts could help lower oil prices to his favored level of $50 a barrel, according to people familiar with the matter. A plan under construction envisions the U.S. exerting some control over Venezuela's state-run oil company, Petróleos de Venezuela S.A., or PD-VSA, including acquiring and marketing the bulk of the company's oil production, people familiar with the matter said. If successful, the plan could effectively give the U.S. stewardship of most of the oil reserves in the Western Hemisphere when factoring deposits in the U.S. and other countries where American companies control production. It could also fulfill two of the administration's primary goals: to box Russia and China out of Venezuela, and to push energy prices lower for U.S. consumers. Trump doctrine confounds allies, foes, by Yaroslav Trofimov. President Trump's new Donroe doctrine, loudly proclaimed by the seizure of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro, and the president's assertion that Washington now runs the Latin American country, seeks to establish U.S. hegemony over the entire Western Hemisphere. The question U.S. adversaries and allies are asking themselves in the aftermath of the Caracas raid is whether this embrace of 19th century style imperial thinking also means a pivot away from the rest of the world that would give China and Russia greater sway in their neighborhoods. It's not a world dominance that Trump is trying to achieve, but a hemispheric dominance, German lawmaker Norbert Röttgen said. His worldview seems to be thinking in categories of spheres of influence and dominance by those in other hemispheres who are the most powerful there, irrespective of rules, laws, and alliances. Buoyed by the success of the January 3rd operation in Venezuela, Trump has signaled potential U.S. intervention in Cuba, Colombia, Mexico, the Danish possession of Greenland, and outside the Americas, Iran. Russia and China, which have invested tens of billions of dollars and considerable diplomatic capital in the Maduro regime, have reacted with restraint. In part, that is because they hope Washington will now be more accommodating of their own aspirations in Europe and Asia, respectively, either by design or because of inherent limits on U.S. resources. Beijing is captivated by Trump's interest in spheres of influence of major powers, said Tang Zhuo, a senior fellow at the Carnegie China Research Center. It's interesting in exploring whether the U.S. is willing to make major compromises in the Western Pacific, including on the issue of Taiwan and the South China Sea, if China shows greater deference to the U.S. in the Americas. The same calculations are in play in Moscow as Washington pushes Ukraine to accept a peace deal that would satisfy some of Russia's key demands, including a surrender of territory that Russian forces haven't captured in 4 years of war. Trump is tough with the weak, but weak with the tough. And the only people for whom he has respect are Putin and Xi, which is why he is seeking deals with them, said Raphael Glucksmann, a prominent French member of the European Parliament, who has called for European nations to deploy troops to Greenland as a show of support for its democracy. The Donroe Doctrine leaves us with the question of whether President Trump sees Europe, the Kingdom of Denmark, Greenland, and the NATO countries as allies and partners in security, or as adversaries and enemies, said Jeppe Kofod, a former Danish foreign minister. New diet guidelines, eat more protein, less sugar, by Jesse Newman, Liz Esley White, and Andrea Peterson. Trump administration officials made sweeping changes to U.S. dietary guidelines, recommending that people avoid highly processed foods, dramatically increase protein intake, and skip added sugar. The new guidelines issued Wednesday urged people to cook more meals at home, avoid packaged food like chips, cookies, and candy, and eat protein at every meal. They echo the government's previous advice that fruits, vegetables, whole grains, poultry, seafood, and nuts form the basis of a healthy diet. But they also endorse foods like red meat and full-fat dairy, while taking a hard line against highly processed foods, added sugar, and refined carbohydrates like white bread. The recommendations issued by the U.S. Agriculture and Health and Human Services Departments represent one of the biggest remakes of federal dietary advice since the guidelines were first issued in 1980. How Google got its AI groove back. Powerful new Gemini model allowed it to catch up to OpenAI's ChatGPT by Catherine Blunt. In the wee hours of an August morning, an artificial intelligence project manager at Google loaded the newest creation from its DeepMind lab onto a platform that ranks AI models. Google had fallen behind in the AI race, while its rival, OpenAI, had attracted hundreds of millions of users to its ChatGPT chatbot. Google researchers were hoping that a new feature, a lightning-fast image generator, would give the search titan an edge in a weak spot for ChatGPT. Naina Razanhani, known inside Google for working late into the night, needed a name for the new tool to complete the upload. It was 2:30 a.m., though, and nobody was around. So she just made one up, a mashup of two nicknames friends had given her, Nano Banana. Within days, Nano Banana had the top spot in performance rankings on the platform LM Arena, was trending on X and had far exceeded Google's usage expectations. By September, Google's Gemini AI app had become the most downloaded app in Apple's App Store. 2 months later, Google launched its most powerful Gemini model yet, which surged past competitors to become the most capable AI chatbot. With that, the Alphabet-owned company had leapfrogged OpenAI to the front of the AI pact. Talks over Greenland are planned. Officials from U.S., Denmark, and Greenland to address security concerns. By Max Colchester, Lawrence Norman, and Robbie Gramer. Nuke Greenland. For the past year, Denmark's plan for dealing with President Trump's ambition to acquire Greenland was to tell him it wasn't for sale, spend more on Arctic defense, and hope the U.S. president's enthusiasm would melt away. As talks were set for next week, there is a growing realization in the Greenlandic capital that Trump's fixation on the world's biggest island is here to stay, and that Greenlanders must come up with a plan to engage with the U.S. I believe that most Greenlandic people see that they need to have that dialogue, said Aki Matilda Hogdam, a Greenlandic pro-independence politician. A U.S. takeover of Greenland, once seen as a far-fetched idea, looms ever larger in Nuuk after Trump and some of his top aides renewed their demands for control of the island following the U.S. military incursion in Venezuela. The White House hasn't ruled out taking the island by force. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told lawmakers in a closed briefing on Monday that recent administration threats against Greenland didn't signal an imminent invasion and that the goal is to buy the island from Denmark. Rubio said on Wednesday that he would meet with Danish and Greenlandic officials in Washington next week after the Danes requested a meeting in hope of addressing criticism directed at them by the Trump administration. Trump has said the U.S. needs Greenland as a matter of national security and has criticized Denmark's defenses on the island. Copenhagen has countered that the U.S. has a military presence there and could work with Greenland and Denmark to expand it. Trying to get the U.S. to dial back its demands, Copenhagen says it wants to address security concerns with Washington. It seems that asking for a meeting with Rubio is a step up in this strategy, said Ulrik Prom-Gad, senior researcher with the Danish Institute for International Studies. In Nuuk, people are divided about how best to engage, whether they can use Trump's embrace as a means to gain independence from Denmark, a policy a majority of Greenlanders support. Still, the brusque nature of Trump's overtures hasn't been welcomed by the government. Greenland's Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen called Trump's rhetoric completely and utterly unacceptable. Trump's threats so far have largely bolstered ties between Denmark and Greenland, with the former making strides to show her attention on the island, which is subsidized at $600 million a year. Polls show that Greenlanders don't want to be part of the U.S. The Danish government, which has a long-standing defense agreement with the U.S., has said the U.S. could base more troops in Greenland and obtain new and improved mining rights. Greenland serves as a critical location for missile warning and missile defense for the U.S. Its melting ice sheet opens up the possibility for new commercial and military sea lanes, which Washington sees as a potential threat. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, Trump's Venezuela oil play. The regime may be using oil to buy Trump's support to stay in power. In another striking show of force, the U.S. military on Wednesday seized two sanctioned oil tankers on the open sea. This followed President Trump's declaration late Tuesday that the U.S. would sell sanctioned Venezuelan oil. The oil gambit could be useful, though only if it advances the imperative of creating a free and prosperous Venezuela. As we've written, deposing Nicolas Maduro was an act of hemispheric hygiene. But Mr. Trump's incessant talk about monetizing Venezuela's oil plays into the hands of critics who say it's all about oil. The president in recent days has suggested subsidizing American oil companies to return to Venezuela, as if it's an imperial American outpost from a century ago. His plan to sell Venezuelan oil raises more questions. The government, quote, will be turning over between 30 and 50 million barrels, end of quote, for the U.S. to sell. And that money will be controlled by me as President of the United States of America, to ensure it is used to benefit the people of Venezuela and the United States, he wrote on Truth Social. Selling sanctioned oil could do some good if the proceeds are given to the opposition or put in an escrow account for rebuilding Venezuela's economy when and if the regime relinquishes power. But Mr. Trump seems to view the oil proceeds as a personal executive account beyond the control of Congress's purse strings to dole out as he sees fit. It elides U.S. national security interest with Mr. Trump's personal power, much like his gambit to let TikTok keep operating in the U.S., in violation of the law on the condition that the Treasury get a cut of its eventual sale to American investors. To the victor, go the oil spoils won't improve U.S. standing in the world, and it sends a bad message to the world's rogues about the way to buy U.S. support. This will be reinforced if the oil donation helps the Caracas regime stay in power. Energy Secretary Chris Wright suggested Wednesday that the administration will use the oil money as a carrot with the regime. He said the U.S. first plans to sell crude that is backed up in storage because of the U.S. embargo. Then it will continue to sell Venezuelan supply and ease sanctions to boost production. As we make progress with the government, we will enable the import of parts, equipment, and services to prevent the industry from collapsing, stabilize the production, he said. Venezuela has been relying on assistance from the Iranians and Chinese to prevent its aging oil infrastructure from collapsing. U.S. investment is preferable, but easing sanctions so American companies can operate in Venezuela won't necessarily evict adversaries with their own strategic reasons for abetting the regime. In any case, U.S. companies are unlikely to invest in Venezuela until a political transition creates stability and respects property rights. Oil investment is measured in decades, not the next 3 years. Merely maintaining current output will require billions of dollars a year and $100 billion or more to return production to the levels of the early 2010s. U.S. companies have other attractive opportunities that carry less political risk, such as offshore Guyana, where ExxonMobil and Chevron are making big investments. Harold Hamm's Continental Resources is expanding in Argentina's Vaca Muerta shale formation. Don't forget America's own resources, including in the Gulf of Mexico and Alaska. Mr. Trump may be able to coerce Chevron to invest more in Venezuela or dangle subsidies as he has suggested, but this is dubious industrial policy. The president's oil gambit could turn out better than all of this suggests, and it's good to see him still enforcing the embargo to maintain pressure on the regime. Wednesday's seizures of a Russian flag tanker in the Atlantic and a shadow carrier near the Caribbean sent a signal to the regime and America's adversaries that the president is serious. But Venezuela's overflowing storage facilities are forcing wells to be shut in, raising the stakes for the regime. Mr. Trump's plan to sell stored oil could provide a relief valve. We hope Mr. Trump understands that the success of his intervention won't be measured in barrels of oil, but in whether the country emerges as an American ally in a crucial region. Now for articles from the opinion pages. Ahead in 2026. You read it here first. My predictions: a split Congress, slower growth, and Denver in the Super Bowl. By Carl Rove. Before offering my predictions for 2026, let's review my score for 2025. I had about 56% right, 42% wrong, 2% one prediction to be determined. What did I get right? Deportation of violent criminal illegal aliens was popular. Targeting aliens who had otherwise kept their noses clean wasn't. State and local governments threw up roadblocks to both. Mike Johnson was reelected House Speaker, not without drama. President Trump and GOP congressional leaders negotiated with Democrats to avoid a spring shutdown. Elon Musk's much ballyhooed Doge cuts came up well short of its $2 trillion goal. The president, Mr. Musk, and Vivek Ramaswamy fell out. There was no Ukrainian ceasefire. Friedrich Merz became German chancellor. Canada isn't a state. Denmark didn't cede Greenland. The Panama Canal remains Panamanian. Inflation slowed from 2.9% to 2.7%. Artificial intelligence is transforming medicine. NASA launched its new space-based observatory, Sphere X. Josh Allen was NFL MVP, Jaden Daniels Offensive Rookie of the Year, Aaron Rodgers didn't return to the Jets, and the Chiefs didn't win the Super Bowl. Two of my predictions were half right. Justin Trudeau isn't Canada's prime minister, but the Conservatives didn't beat him. His Liberal Party pushed him out and staved off defeat. Mr. Trump used tariffs to get concessions on trade, immigration, and defense from more than a dozen countries. But he slapped tariffs on many other nations, often seemingly for the heck of it. My incorrect predictions. Congress passed one reconciliation package, not two. Mr. Trump didn't lose any controversial cabinet confirmation fights. He got tax breaks on tips, overtime, and Social Security. 25 Republicans didn't vote against raising the debt ceiling, though I'm sure they wanted to. The Supreme Court didn't issue an opinion on birthright citizenship. No justice retired. Republicans lost the Wisconsin and Pennsylvania state Supreme Court races. There was no Israel-Saudi Arabia peace accord. Benjamin Netanyahu is still in office. Tariffs appear on track to produce more than 2.5% of federal revenue, albeit barely. The S&P 500 did better than I anticipated. My Oscar picks were a bust. Wicked didn't win Best Picture, Ralph Fiennes Best Actor, or Denzel Washington Best Supporting Actor. Still undecided whether 2025 gross domestic product growth was greater than 2024's 2.8%. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says it'll be 3%. Hope he's right. What does my 2026 crystal ball say? The House goes Democratic. The Senate remains Republican. The GOP breaks even on governorships. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro emerges as the 2028 Democratic hopeful who most helped himself. The mega civil war grows. The Supreme Court affirms birthright citizenship, allows political parties to raise unlimited contribution, and rules against Mr. Trump on tariffs. He imposes new ones based on different authorities, some limited in duration or requiring congressional approval. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement is renewed with modest changes. The House approves a majority of appropriations bills under regular order. Congress keeps the government running until January 30th with a continuing resolution and no significant shutdown. Congress overrides a Trump veto. Americans don't get a $2,000 tariff rebate. Republicans can't pass major health care reform. Inflation stays above 2%, and GDP grows less than in 2025. The S&P 500 rises less than half of 2025's increase. The Trump gold card, permanent residency for 1 million, generates huge demand. The Kennedy Center isn't the last building or program on which Mr. Trump tacks his name. He ends December with lower approval than today. There's no Ukrainian peace deal. Realizing Vladimir Putin is playing him, Mr. Trump steps up support for Kyiv. Russia increases hybrid warfare against the West. Greenland stays Danish, but with a larger U.S. military presence. Center-right parties win in at least two more European countries. Nicolas Maduro's fellow gangsters remain in office, but Venezuela moves toward elections. Growing unrest in Iran forces the mullahs to make economic reforms, crimping their terror activities. More states and countries ban cell phones in schools. Generation Z church attendance rises.
led by GLP-1 drugs, weight loss will accelerate. Norway wins the most Winter Olympic medals. England takes the World Cup. The Broncos, the Super Bowl. Matthew Stafford is NFL MVP. No Oscar picks. The Academy has lost its mind. Mr. Rove was senior advisor and deputy chief of staff for President George W. Bush and is author of The Triumph of William McKinley. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Venezuela's moment. Unconstrained by hypocrisy, Trump is an invitation to the country's opposition. By Holman W. Jenkins, Jr. Delcy Rodriguez, the Maduro vice president in Venezuela, must have watched 60 Minutes. On Sunday night, a longtime U.S. envoy known personally to her spelled it out. Look, find a way. Work toward cooperating with the United States. She got the message saying she was ready to collaborate. The U.S. will control the oil. It will be satisfied with any regime remnants that can organize themselves and come toward Donald Trump. Reportedly, this unsentimental approach was communicated in advance to the Maduro crowd. The CIA's now leaked advice to President Trump was that a pro-Maduro rump would be the safest bet, hence the relative ease with which the regime gave up its kingpin, hence Mr. Trump's disinterest in the Nobel Prize-winning oppositionist Maria Corina Machado. With its half-accomplished feat, the administration hopes unblocking Venezuela's current oil exports will provide enough leverage over the Caracas survivors. Its larger desired message, after all, has been delivered across Latin America. Your path to success isn't defiance of the U.S. and engaging in hostile activities against it. So much for the storybook ending in Venezuela itself. Democracy plus a big investment boom to revive decrepit oil potential, which would require a long-term political stability than Team Trump seems ready to provide. So here we are. One risk is that responsible governments in the region will do more, not less, to reach out to China to offset an unpredictable U.S. But with Mr. Trump, it can help that yesterday's cause celebre is ancient history a week later. The other risk, a Caracas regime conditioned from the ground up to thieving and using leftist blather as cover, will not go long without reverting to pattern. In reporting all this, the U.S. media gaslighted itself with memories of Iraq. By keeping buttoned up about his plans and intentions, Team Trump appears to have spared itself the Pottery Barn rule. This is a reversion to U.S. pattern. RFD had no trouble distinguishing their SOBs from our SOBs. Kennedy eliminated a South Vietnamese leader to advance his war effort. Eisenhower saw replacing unreliable Third World leaders as a Cold War necessity. The Mouse That Roared, a 1959 film, gently mocked the idea that every U.S. war was World War II, with the U.S. rushing in to reform and rebuild its enemies. A puzzle for another day is the failure of Maduro's vaunted Cuban security team. Much as Iran was hopelessly owned by Israeli intelligence and the Kremlin couldn't keep its Ukraine invasion plans secret from anybody except its own officials. A puzzle for today is the sluggish response of the opposition, led by Ms. Machado. Take over a floor in a Washington hotel, hold court, plaster your message all over global media, get a plane and paint it in the national colors, announce a date for your return to Caracas. When 200,000 turn out at the airport to greet you, it's over. The country's yours. Mr. Trump has assumed large risks. The emergence of a self-legitimizing popular government in Venezuela is his best solution to those risks. You might even wish more presidents had his capacity to be untrapped by his priors. His enemies conjured for him an image as a Putin crony. On being returned to office, he used it to present himself as a neutral mediator in the Ukraine war, result yet to be determined. The same enemies insist his hemispheric focus means he's ready to cede Taiwan to China and Kyiv to Moscow. Except that's not what we're seeing. Mr. Trump ships weapons to Taiwan. And as the New York Times recently uncovered, he's been an eager supporter of Ukraine's strikes on Russian oil infrastructure. The Trump administration has many faults, but it adapts to the world as it exists. The next reality ought to be the Venezuelan opposition and its 70% majority taking the initiative. Mr. Trump will follow. He likes nothing better than to see which team is winning and put himself and the U.S. on its side. His strategic concepts and impulses are open to interpretation. He identifies U.S. interests as he goes and pursues them with unrestrained gusto. He doesn't send strong signals about what urgent American interest he might identify next or how he will act on it. But we can probably guess. Should Greenland worry? It's a subject we've touched on before. Maybe a Greenland that, post-independence from Denmark, gives rise to a Maduro. But this is a bridge a future administration would have to cross, or maybe not, thanks to Mr. Trump's unvarnished signaling today. The ball now is in the court of Venezuela's opposition and its resilient civil society. Take control of your own story. What's the difference between a Democrat and a socialist? The question stumped the DNC head in 2015. The answer is as elusive as ever in the age of Mandani. By Jason L. Riley. What's the difference between a Democrat and a socialist? That was the question MSNBC's Chris Matthews posed to Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Democrat from Florida, in 2015 when she was ahead of the Democratic National Committee. Ms. Wasserman Schultz at first seemed flustered. The more important question is, what is the difference between being a Democrat and being a Republican? She replied eventually. But Mr. Matthews pressed her. I used to think there was a big difference, he said. What do you think it is? A Democrat like Hillary Clinton and a socialist like Bernie Sanders? Mr. Matthews never received a clear answer from the Congresswoman that day, and more than a decade later, we're still waiting for one. In his inaugural address last week, New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani made no bones about where he stood on labels. We will govern without shame and insecurity, making no apology for what we believe, he said. I was elected as a democratic socialist, and I will govern as a democratic socialist. I will not abandon my principles for fear of being deemed radical. For the new mayor, governing as a socialist means prioritizing group interest over individual interest. Property rights are conditional, and private enterprise is useful only insofar as it serves the public interest as determined by politicians and bureaucrats. The government's proper role is to redistribute wealth as Mr. Mandani and his fellow political elites see fit. To those who insist that the era of big government is over, hear me when I say this: no longer will City Hall hesitate to use its power to improve New Yorkers' lives, Mr. Mandani said. For too long, we have turned to the private sector for greatness. This is the mindset that produced the mayor's campaign promises to freeze rents, create city-run grocery stores, deliver universal child care, and make public transportation fast and free. Despite a track record of failure and human suffering that spans continents and dates back more than a century, central planners have boundless confidence in their ability to allocate resources and make good decisions for the rest of us. We will return the vast resources of this city to the workers, Mr. Mandani said. This moment demands a new politics and a new approach to power. Is this approach really new, or is it simply a less nuanced version of what the left has been pushing off and on for most of the past two decades with mixed results? It's tempting to conclude that the distinction between a Democrat and a socialist today is nothing more than semantic, but Democrats who prevailed in last year's elections might take exception. Mikey Sherrill, who was elected governor of New Jersey by 13 points, has a military background, embraces capitalism, and made it clear throughout her campaign that I am not a democratic socialist. Abigail Spanberger, who defeated her Republican opponent by 15 points to become governor of Virginia, previously spent three terms in Congress urging her party to move to the center. We need to not ever use the word socialist or socialism ever again, she has warned. As the midterm elections approach, Republican officials would like nothing better than to make Gotham's mayor the face of the Democratic Party, but their digs at Mr. Mandani's socialism would have more credibility if they weren't giving the Trump administration a free pass. According to the Tax Foundation, Mr. Trump's tariffs amount to the largest U.S. tax increase as a percentage of gross domestic product since 1993. And it's hard to seem credible knocking proposals for government-run grocery stores to control food prices when you support government-run pharmacies to control drug prices. Give Democratic Socialist Zoran Mandani credit for practicing something rare among elected officials: truth in advertising. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the January 8, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening.